Tom Carey and Don Schmidt with us. The general came to Roswell. If it happened on the 3rd, the 4th was actually a holiday. When did the general show up?
Would have been the morning of the 7th. It was right after Major Marcel and Captain Sheridan Cabot of the Counterintelligence Corps returned back from the debris field with the first recovery of debris. Now, we always remind people, keep in mind, first of all, that the rancher doesn't even report the crash for a number of days after he's first discovered it. So that material has been out there for now up to 3 to 4 days. And for those of us who have flown over the area in small planes and in helicopters, this is high desert. It's just totally unobscured. There are no trees or landmarks of any sort. So once airborne, you can see literally for 50 to 100 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So for that material to be scattered out there, whether it be Mogul balloon or anything else top secret, the fact that nobody was looking for it, to us, establishes our argument that if it wasn't being looked for, then it wasn't ours.
Right.
And if it wasn't ours, then whose was it?
It's a good you know, you mentioned logic, and one thing Larry Dickin and I discussed the other night was basically, if we were in a court of law, we could take the evidence that you two have come up with, and we probably could win a case on circumstantial evidence.
I don't know that. Yes.
It would be the Empire State Building
against the weight of evidence, right.
Yes,
And certainly all the deathbed testimony being admissible in a court of law.
Yeah,
evidence.
Overwhelming.
Have you had any official response from anybody? Like a congressman, senator, or somebody says, hey.
To our book?
Yeah.
Not yet.
It's too soon, but we certainly miss the efforts and many of the public statements of support from the late Congressman Stephen Schiff. And even after the first Project Mogul report in September of 1994, and I called him up directly and I said, well, does this end your involvement? And he said, absolutely not. It only will intensify it. Because he would then later go on to actually state that he accused the Air Force of a massive ongoing cover-up. Now, that's a pretty strong charge from a reigning member of Congress at that time.
Right.
And sadly, he would die within a few years.
And you're convinced that Senator Goldwater knew about this?
Well, he was told of it. It's just unfortunate that, as he even would decry the attempt on numerous occasions, and specifically would then chair the Joint Chiefs, General Curtis LeMay.
Yes.
And as he would say, it was the only time that LeMay ever cussed him out.
Yeah, I remember reading that article.
Goldwater was a reserve Air Force general.
Brigadier General, right.
U.S. Senator, he had heard the stories. And to use his terminology, he wanted access to the Blue Room at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where the artifacts from these crashes, not only Roswell, but maybe some others were stored.
Mm-hmm.
He said, the General, might I get in there? And like Don says, General LeMay just blew up at him.
Hell no, and don't ever ask me.
Yeah, right.
And if you ever bring it up again, I will personally see that you're court-martialed. Yeah.
When we talk about Wright-Patterson, do we know if the bodies were taken there?
Well, the testimony is that there were two flights.
Okay.
One, this so-called Pappy Henderson flight, Captain Pappy Henderson, pilot of a C-54 cargo plane, flew out some of the wreckage, and the first set of bodies that were found.
Just from north of town here, right?
North of town, the impact site. That was on July the 8th. The very next day, we have a second flight. This is a special B-29 named Straight Flush. These were the bodies. We call them the stinky bodies because they were out there longer and they smelled.
Mm-hmm.
They were taken to, instead of going straight to Wright-Patterson, they went to Fort Worth first. And then they went to Wright-Patterson. Those were the bodies from the Foster Ranch that Mac Razzle had.
Right, right.
And we have testimony from personnel who were at that particular site. In the book, we even describe the photographer, Frederick Benthal, that was assigned to take the pictures. the bodies at the Brazel Ranch. We can trace them then.
Is he a military photographer?
No, he was.
No, he was military.
He was military, but he was in Washington. So no, he wasn't here at the base, but he arrived from Washington.
Okay, they sent somebody out special.
Right, that they brought him in from Washington, and then we can track the bodies to Building 84. From there to the base hospital, and from there to a tent that was set up on the far south end of the tarmac. And even one of the MPs, a Native American, the name of Ed Harrison, who was assigned to guard this tent with an erected fence.
And when, so they couldn't get inside.
So they couldn't get inside. But the next morning when they arrived to relieve the previous detail, everything was gone, and all they could see were the heavy tracks of what appeared to be a B-29 that taxied over the area and picked something up. And from there, we can trace the bodies to a crate at bomb pit number one, where they would normally keep one of the atomic bombs. And then this bomb, this cargo, this crate is loaded into the back of the straight flush B-29 that Tom mentioned.
And we interviewed all of the non-coms on that flight. We believe there's one officer still living, but he, since he found out why we were calling, he changed his phone
number.
Wow. What did the non-coms say?
They said that they were on the flight.
I mean, that'd be like the flight sergeant.
In fact,
the like
late
that.
Lloyd Thompson even kept the manifest of the flight.
Oh, did he?
So we can document the flight. The time it left from Roswell, the personnel on the flight, and as Tom was saying.
And that's how you figured out who was there?
Tracking down Robert Slusher and Felix Martucci. And
Robert Osen.
Arthur Chook, right there.
And Slusher and one other. Today they say it was that they took the bodies. But at the time they thought, well, I wonder if this has something to do with all that flying saucer talk back at the base, especially the little bodies. And they got to thinking when they saw there was a ring of MPs around this
pit.
Well, around the pit, and they followed the box into the bomb bay. They guarded the bomb, bomb bay on the flight to Fort Worth. Now, the B-29 cruises at 29,000 feet. This flight, this particular flight, flew at 8,000 feet because of the MPs in the bomb bay. Why would MPs be guarding a crate with balloon fragments inside it? It just didn't make sense. Now, one of the MPs recognized one of the guards as a flight surgeon from the base, the Roswell base.
Oh, really?
And when they landed in Fort Worth, in the waiting party, one of the officers on the B-29 recognized a friend of his who was a military mortician.
Now, you mentioned flight surgeon, military morticians. What about the live ET? I mean, he must have laid out there for a while before somebody discovered him, huh? Is he out there 2 or 3 days?
It would have been for a number of days, correct.
And then did he go to the hospital here, or what did they do with him?
The information was that he was taken to the base hospital, and even the new military witness, one of the MPs, Eli Benjamin, in describing the transfer of the gurneys from Hangar 84 then to an examination room at the hospital, and then where they were posted standing guard. We obviously we can't trail.
And I'm sure you guys would love it too to see the medical records for that. You know,
would love to see anything related.
So he made a noise. He said shrill.
But we even tell the story in the book of the hospital administrator secretary Miriam Bush, and how she was taken by the administrator into an examination room, and where her first reaction was that, "My God, there are children on these gurneys," and then she saw one of them move, and then she noticed the heads, and it was, "Oh my God, they aren't human."
Now, Walter saw the head from 150 feet. Did you see one or two?
Closer.
Oh, it was closer.
That's right. But he, too, that they were the size of children based on the outline under the canvas tarp. But the heads were exposed. The lighting wasn't the best, as he would describe, but that the heads were disproportionately larger. He couldn't make out any features. but that all indications were that they were the crew, that they were the bodies from the crash, and would describe also the egg shape, almost the, we always use the size of a Volkswagen Beetle.
You're pretty certain that this, I guess we'll call it an escape pod at this point.
Or inside cabin.
Or whatever it is.
Capsule.
Right, right.
And even the descriptions.
It was intact, or was it cracked open? I hear all kinds of stories.
Most of the testimony is, oh, it was egg-shaped. Or
yeah.
It's somewhat certain. We have testimony from two, that they thought the one end of it was damaged. Just one end of it.
Okay. Which would be natural if he had a huge explosion.
But for the first time in the book, we also are able to identify the driver of the 18-wheeler, the lowboy,
that
left from the base to go out to the site north of town.
To pick it up.
So the very idea that they would also dispatch an 18-wheel flatbed truck to pick up the ship, and then the witnesses here in town, including even two paper boys at that time, who said that they stood in the corner here of Main and Second and watched as it even would make the turn coming down Main Street and then turn here on the Second. And at that time, the stoplights were suspended by cables and that it couldn't clear the cables, and how the soldiers had to jump out and get up on top of the truck and lift the cables so it could, and then proceed to the east side of the base and then cut through the tarmac across the runway and come directly to Building 84, totally avoiding the front gate.
When obviously there was a move for secrecy, but at the same time when you start using a lot of civilian people, they surely realize that there would be some leaks.
Well, it's been leaking for
60 years.
And just think back to when Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer, first talked about this in 1978, and I was head of intelligence and I handled the material.
That's,
and it was not from this earth,
right.
And the only publication at that time that even picks up the story is the National Enquirer.
Yeah.
So if I'm next in line, I don't think I'm going to come forward that quick.
Yeah. You mentioned Marcel. Tell us a little bit about his reaction. He went to Fort Worth, I guess, to Carswell Air Force Base with the wreckage, and he went down the hall and came back and had been substituted. Is that right?
Yes. We get that from Walter Howe.
Yeah, that was from Walter.
Okay.
When he took some of the wreckage up to General Ramey, put it on his desk, Ramey said, come with me, Major. Show me on the map where this spot was that you found it. And so they go into the map room, and a few minutes pass, and he points out where it was, in the Foster Ranch, in central northern Mexico. He comes back out. The box of wreckage is gone, and in its place on the floor is a pristine radar target that someone had ripped apart to simulate being wrecked. Also was a rubber balloon that by the age of it did not belong with that radar target. It was decaying, it was black. Normally they're white or gray.
So it's a last-minute reaction. My God, we need to cover this up.
And as the photographer from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, James Bond Johnson, originally told us, that it reeked of rubber even as he approached the general's office, and he just couldn't believe that the general would allow, that chunk of rotting neoprene rubber to be scattered on the floor in his office.
In the end, Marcel said he felt like a fall guy. For this, they had him pose with this balloon and tinfoil and balsa wood that any 6 year old would recognize as balsa wood, tinfoil, and rubber.
We'll be right back. I want to talk to you about Walter Haught and Marcel. Did they communicate at all during these years? After the service, do you know?
There's no indication.
Walter never mentioned it or anything.
What was interesting, we pointed out in the book that Walter stayed in contact with some rather curious people within the military, including the head of counterintelligence, not here at Roswell, but at Fort Worth, Texas, who was obviously under General Ramey.
Mm-hmm.
And we mentioned one specific Christmas card that was sent, at this time, maybe 15 years ago, that at the end said, and I still say there were no bodies brought here to Fort Worth. And this was from Milton Knight, who was the head of counterintelligence at Fort Worth, Texas, mm-hmm. under General Ramey. So why should he have remained in contact with Walter Hott after all that time? So it was rather curious to us.
So you, maybe it's just to see if Walter's going to break?
Or keep tabs, stay in contact. It's one way of maintaining some level of intimidation and certainly surveillance.
Or to give him the story he should go with.
We'll be right back. We have 15 more minutes. This is incredible. And I'm Jerry Pippin, and of course our guests are Tom Carey and Don Smith. Smith back with us, and the book is available. It's on back order most places, but that means it's popular, guys.
Very popular. We're in the second printing after 3 weeks.
You knew it was going to be a big seller.
Oh, I don't think any author is so presumptuous.
I don't know. You had some pretty, smoking gun things here.
What we did, Jerry, is that it's been 10 years since the last Roswell book, the 50th anniversary.
Right.
We thought there was a need, of people that they wanted to know more. The 60th anniversary.
Well, basically, I wasn't insinuating as you're writing a bestseller here for the sake of making the money. I was talking about basically you just knew it was going to be a hot item.
No.
You didn't?
No.
Okay.
We hope,
but one of the problems, as we all have realized within the last years, there are very few books in the UFO books in the stores.
True.
And just about, we've been told that ours is the only one that's actually published this year, that everything else is basically self-published.
That's true. In the radio business, UFO shows are very popular, but advertising agencies...
it's still a taboo topic.
Yeah, right.
What has happened, maybe Don will agree with me, is we have all this information that we have gathered in the last 9 years that's new, beyond what was published in 1997. You have the 60th anniversary. You have a public out there that is still interested in this story. You have the convergence of a perfect storm. And that's what we believe is going on with our book at this time.
Now, your witnesses, as you did the investigation, did you run across people that just out and out lied to you? I get some pretty wild stories sometimes, so I don't know.
I think we're also...
I'm not asking you to name names.
No, but we're also in a position with the accumulation of all...
So you could detect, you didn't pass the smell test.
And one of the first smell tests is when they approach us, when they contact us. Hey, you forgot me. Or why didn't you ever contact me? Because 99% of the time, upon our first approaching them, their immediate response is, how did you ever find me? So in other words, it's the last thing they expected. They would... in most cases, hope that they would live out the remainder of their lives and never be asked a single question about this. But unfortunately, we come knocking. We come calling. How many times have we just blindly gone to people's front doors with every
I find that's the best approach, the shock value.
Well, and it has worked for us.
Yeah, right.
It has worked for us.
When they're coming forward... waving their hand, interview me.
Yeah,
a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I understand that. Now, I immediately knew from our conversations last year that you're going to have a book out with some new witnesses. But you actually have a lot of witnesses. How many new witnesses do you have?
There's more than are in the book.
Okay,
we have plenty.
Because, well, I was thinking maybe two or three, but no, there's a bunch.
In each chapter.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing, because these chapters, you guys could sell this to a magazine, by the way. Each chapter stand alone.
But that was the format of the book, mm-hmm. that you could read any one chapter, put it down, and not lose any, as far as flow of the storyline, that each chapter stands on its own. So in other words, hence even the title, as far as Witness to Roswell, that we afford each one of these witnesses or groups of witnesses from their separate vantage points, whether from the ranch, whether from the press, whether from the base here at Roswell, whether from Fort Worth or Washington, D.C., to describe what they observed firsthand, what their families were told firsthand by their fathers, their husbands, and so on. And I think it continues to paint an amazing story. And the overall writing point in all this is none of the witnesses are telling us that it is anything but a flying saucer.
Now, we mentioned earlier that in a circumstantial legal case, you guys have got a huge weight of evidence, probably could get a conviction or a finding if it's a civil case. Let's make a summary here, counselors. Tell me a little bit about what you've done here.
Well, in our book is not meant to be a be-all and end-all of the Roswell case. Mm-hmm. That would be the next book.
Okay.
This book...
So you do have another book, you hope?
Of course.
Okay. Especially since it wasn't selling.
What we attempted to do in this book, Jerry, is to set out many of the new witnesses that we have found, and rather than have us interpret their words, to let them speak for themselves about what they saw, what they witnessed, what they heard, in their own words. And we, of course, try to keep it in some sort of context.
Well, the reason I brought this up is because obviously you believed in this case all along, but as you got these witnesses, it had to really give you some strength in your belief.
But actually, I don't know if that was the case with Tom, but certainly in my case, I did not believe in it at first.
Oh, really?
Started out as a complete skeptic.
So you came down here as a skeptic,
as
huh?
a complete skeptic. Kevin Randall and I originally, we thought
I know Kevin. One
trip to Roswell, New Mexico, and we would wrap this up. And for the first few days...
Well, you've been coming back, Don.
That appeared to be the case. But then when we actually started to talk to, like, the rancher's son, Bill Jr., and others who had actually handled the material, and when they were describing the characteristics, and not only the fiber optics, but the memory material that you could crumble and crease, and it would lay down and smooth right out without a sign of a crease or fold, we left thinking, maybe we need to come back, because what if we're wrong? And that's a challenge that we always issue to the press as well. If we're wrong, it doesn't change anything. It doesn't change history. It doesn't change one's perspective on life or on society. But regarding the press, if they're wrong, if they've turned as far as a deaf ear to this entire story, which we believe is the biggest story of the millennium, that is malpractice, journalistic malpractice in our eyes. The idea that it was right there for them to take and run with, and tried to establish, pro or con, whether it was legitimate or not, and they walked away from it. They ridiculed it. They wouldn't touch it.
One of the things that I thought was really astounding was Peter Jennings referring to it as a myth.
Which
seemed like that had been added at the last, but we don't know.
We were with Peter Jennings' crew.
And that's the reason I wanted to bring it, because you guys were with him
for a while.
Almost a week, and... I think we knew from the get-go. As hard as we tried, it was like, the movie Independence Day, when they're trying to shoot the missiles, and the missiles can't get through. They just keep bouncing off.
So he had a shield.
He had a shield. We could not, no matter what we said, we could tell by the look in their eyes, their face, that they had a
agenda.
And he declared it a myth, just like
five times in the opening paragraph of that segment.
Yes.
But what we, and for all of the attempts for them to interview any of our primary witnesses.
I mean, there was a lot of hope when the show came up.
Absolutely. But when they wouldn't even talk to the witnesses themselves, we realized, as Tom was saying, that they had an agenda. But what we would learn afterwards is that when they put out a review copy of the program, it did not include the Roswell segment. And then when we actually saw the airing of the program, it was nothing that we had shot. It was all old B-roll from even other networks.
Right.
There we are on CBS 48 Hours, and they're showing that segment. So someone had nixed. Somebody had, you know, basically said, you're not going to air that segment.
Well,
as
yeah,
it
the,
is.
The show, the first hour is put together very professionally.
Very objectively.
And I'm telling you,
very,
the guy's been in business 45 years.
It raised our hopes.
That last hour, it was thrown together.
But there again, that's the standard military tactic, where you the straw man. First you build it up, mm-hmm. then you tear it down.
We're about going. We're all out of time almost, but we're at the Cover Up Cafe here, right down the street from the UFO Museum. What are the hours down there for people that want to come to the
festival? Now 9 till 6, and otherwise from 10 till 5.
Now this program will be on the air tomorrow afternoon and play from now on forever. But for people on the 4th of July weekend, there's still a lot of time to come to Roswell. You may not be able to find a room, but there's a lot of things happening. And you guys are going to be doing some lectures and things, and the media is here, so I'm sure they'll keep you busy too.
And Saturday evening we're doing a panel presentation with Stanton Friedman, Jesse Marcel Jr. So we just completely throw
and that,
it open.
That'll be at the UFO
that'll
Museum.
Be at the museum at 7 p.m. and we throw that open as far as for all the interested people to ask whatever questions they may have on the subject as a whole, or more specifically on Roswell.
Okay, we've been talking with Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. We have a lot of people here at the Cover Up Cafe. Anyone have a question for Tom or Don before we go off the air? If you do, come on over here. Okay, they're bashful a little bit, but we do have an audience here. Might applaud, let everybody know I'm not making it up. No. Rita? Louise is here, Dr. Rita Louise, and we're doing a show on Friday night. And Rita, do you have any questions you might want to ask Tom?
Sure. What made you decide to even get into exploring the whole UFO thing in the first place? You look like regular guys, you know, not airy-fairy kind of weirdo people.
Well, now, Don, I can't...
For me, if it wasn't for Roswell, I wouldn't be... In fact, I'm not into UFOs. Roswell's the only case that I'm...
You're not interested in the other cases, or you
well,
just don't...
The lights in the sky, the, you know, the yeah. front of the building don't interest
I think
me.
What took it back for me was a couple weeks ago when the shuttle had separated from the space station. And then when you could actually go out and watch the one following the other. And it just took me back to my high school years, my teenage years, where I would listen to adults describe about what if. And just the wonderment of not being alone. And it was the type of thing that, and especially having worked with Dr. Hynek, that he always had that little boy wonderment, as they would call it. And he never lost that enthusiasm. And all one has to do is watch one of the old movies and just think, wouldn't it be one of the greatest things of all time? To realize that we're not alone, and that if anybody else could make it, then we should be able to make it too.
Now, Farah Yardoza will be with us tomorrow. You're actually speaking here at the Civic Center when?
Yes, I will be speaking on Saturday and Sunday. I'm giving a presentation about Turkey's 5,000 years old UFO history and cases, and also the approach of Turkish media. And Sunday, I'm going to be giving a workshop. It is about the alien identity in Turkish races.
Right. Now, Farah's going to be over signing books 1 to 3 on Friday, and tomorrow 3 to 5. Your new book's
yes.
out, and what's the name of it?
My new book is in English. This is my fifth book, but this is my first book in English. And the title is Confessions of a Turkish Ufologist.
And if you listen to our shows at all, you know Farah's from Turkey, and Dr. Rita, she's probably the greatest ghost chaser of them all, even though Farah does a little of that work too. She was on what was it, Annie or just Annie? Okay. We went to Jefferson, the most haunted city in Texas, and we both survived.
We did.
Yeah. You think there's a connection between UFOs and paranormal, or are they just both unexplainable?
They're just both unexplainable.
What do you guys think? You think is there something? Is it extraterrestrial, or is there something else going on we don't know about, or you don't know?
You talking about Roswell or UFOs?
Yeah, UFOs.
Well, UFOs are many things, many things, and some of them we believe are nuts and bolts extraterrestrial craft with occupants. What the rest of it is, maybe interdimensional.
Time travel.
And so all of the suspects are possible.
Oh, absolutely.
Speaking of book signings, you're going to be signing down at the UFO Museum. You have some books?
We have a few, and the title again, unless Don has given them all away.
you're supposed to be selling them.
Witness to Roswell Unmasking the 60-Year Cover-Up, and it's doing very well.
Okay, and so they can go into the UFO Museum, and you'll be here through what, through Sunday?
Through Sunday, yes.
Yeah. Anybody else have a question for Don Smith or Tom Carey?
No, I had
Closer to the microphone.
Hi. We bought your book. You? My name is Barbara Atchison. I live in Santa Ana, California.
Good.
And I just wanted to say we purchased your book earlier today. We've already read it, and it's wonderful. We went back to the museum.
You're
to
a
get
speed
more,
reader from Santa Ana.
To get more copies, but we'll have to wait until tomorrow to the open to you
so
open
much.
Again. It's a wonderful, wonderful
that
read.
And one comment that we are hearing over and over again that people can't put it down.
It is a great read. Anyone else have a question about Roswell for Don or Tom? Okay. Here's a friend from Oklahoma.
Yeah. How are you doing?
I saw you in Eureka.
I brought you a present.
Hey, great.
You said something about me playing guitar on radio,
yeah.
So I brought you so you could get a preview, and that way.
Okay. He's a loyal listener, and it's May, right?
Yeah, May. You got it.
Okay.
And I found a room.
Oh, good.
I'm telling you.
I told him, hey, you I don't want to come on to Roswell with your sleeping
car.
This
concerns a researcher that's not present. I don't know how much I should say about it. Linda Moulton House site, the drones over California. You guys have seen those?
Yes.
That's impressive to me. I got pretty excited, especially when the guy from the Palo Alto lab came forward about a week ago, and he showed pictures.
This is the big talk in the UFO area now. Right?
That's all I wanted to mention.
Do you guys have her comment about it at all? Do you follow it?
I know Linda. She lives in Albuquerque now.
Absolute photographs there of an extraterrestrial image covered somewhere, he says.
He says, right.
Yeah.
And Linda is also working on the Missouri crash. I think it was 1941.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the...
She emailed me regarding that, and... What possible help regarding some Freedom of Information Act requests and the minister that was involved with that incident and tracking down some of the surviving family. It's an exciting time.
Things are coming out fast.
Let's hope that we generate a momentum.
This physicist is not using his name. That's got me excited.
And I think that's why, personal differences aside...
If he turns out not to be a Bob Lazar, he turns out to be crazy.
We got a guy on our staff that's still skeptical about it, but I'm not. But the other guy is. And we know who he is, so we'll leave him out of the conversation.
All right.
Talking about, in fact, Larry spent a long time talking to you. He's a very thorough guy, Larry.
Yes, no question. And but in having personal conversations with him, I think I've convinced him, or at least I've addressed his concerns, and he's even provided me with a possible lead on a witness. So,
we all work together on this. We try to.
A few more times with Larry, and we'll win him over.
Okay. Anyone else have a question? Our time's really up here. Rita Louise, we'll be seeing you tomorrow at the Boop, and. Vera Yardoza, we'll see her, and Roberta Scott, our on-location producers here, and Jane Swartley is actually out of Boulder and here engineering the show instead of doing the post-production. Well, we got news for her tomorrow. She's going to have to edit the show and get it up by tomorrow afternoon. Thanks very much, everyone. I've enjoyed it. Thanks, Don. And thanks, Tom. This is Jerry Pippin. Until next time, cheers.